And we're live on the Commercial Real Estate Playbook. How are you doing, Frank?
Outstanding. Outstanding, man. How about you?
Doing well. Doing well. We had something planned for this morning, last minute change. So we decided to use ChatGPT, posted all of our episodes in ChatGPT and said, hey, come up with some awesome questions for us. And now we're going to F it, do it live. What do you think?
Yeah. Yeah. We basically gave the wheel to AI. So if a question sucks, like, let's just call it out. Like, this question sucks, but the robot did it, not us. Let's just do it. Let's see if it works.
Okay, 10 questions. Looking over it initially, I think this would be good for us to jam on. Question number one, what emerging trends in commercial real estate should investors be aware of in 2023?
Losing money. No, I'm just kidding. I think investors should be aware of the halt in deal flow. We talk about it all the time. Bid-ask spreads are really high. And I think that's slowing down the number of transactions, I think, in most asset classes. And it's funny, like, we've been in this boat too. Debt's getting harder to come by, but you could still come in, you know, 40% loan to value, and almost every deal you'll be able to get the loan. And if you're an experienced operator, whatever, but people are just coming in all cash. Like, people are using this opportunity to raise a lot of equity, and they're coming in all cash, I think, to be aggressive on their offers and to try to chew off more on purchase price. So you're seeing, I think, some of the teeth come out for buyers in terms of how they're actually structuring their offers. It's like, hey, all cash or seller finance. And we've done this too, once or twice. So I think that trend is out there. What do you think?
I like it. I think that's a good one. I think the trend that immediately comes to mind for me is bigger players moving down market. I think everyone is trying to move down market, but then acquire at scale in a down market environment, meaning, let's say, traditionally storage investors that were, you know, a large company wouldn't go under 50,000 square feet. Well, now they're saying, hey, what if we buy three, you know, 20,000 square foot facilities in the same town, right? Now we have 60,000, let's buy that, right? And then some of the margin has been greater there. So you're seeing that in all asset classes, where I think bigger players are moving down market, right? And I think as we look at our industrial thesis, I think that's part of what we're trying to play on is, hey, how can we bring larger sums of money to this inefficiently traded, smaller industrial facilities? But mm-hmm. I think we're not the only one with that idea. I think there's a lot of people playing that game.
Yeah. The buy, you know, 20 smaller properties and roll them up strategy has been pretty big the last 5 years. But still, it hasn't been, that market's not efficient everywhere yet, to your points, right? So there's still opportunity out there for sure.
Absolutely. All right. Question two, how has technology impacted the commercial real estate market and what innovations do you see on the horizon?
This is a good one. Data is a really, I think a lot of the technology, if you look at assets like storage, for example, is actually permitting that capital to go further down market to a certain extent. I think 20 years ago, if you were a larger fund, investing in the city of Spartanburg, South Carolina is really scary, right? You're like, hey, the population is under 50,000. The data on this city is, I don't have any, right? I don't know what foot traffic looks like. I don't know what, I have to wait for the census every so many years to actually understand what's going on. And I think the ability to pull data in real time over the course of the last 10 years or so has made people more comfortable investing in tertiary markets, right? Because it's more accessible. It's easier to measure things than it was in the past. So I think ambiguity is lower than it was. And I think that will continue. I also think technology is allowing a lot of investors to operate remotely. I think storage is a great example of this. Now the gate systems and all the tech speak to each other. So you don't need someone there to open up gates for new customers or permit them into the facility. That's a relatively new change for this asset class, and that has made remote management kind of explode. So I think there's other examples of that in other asset classes. I just use storage, but I think those are two trends that are important.
I like it. I think from the strategic perspective, I definitely agree on the data, right? Whether it's CoStar property data or just public records going from the courthouse to online, right? All that property data is there and it's valuable. And then the other thing I would say is kind of the democratization of knowledge. And I would say that has happened to us through Twitter, right? Being able to connect with very successful investors, right? So On the tactical level, sure, like the gates, you know, some of the stuff with the no key locks, some of that stuff is changing at commercial real estate at the tactical level. But I, for me, from my perspective, the bigger tech changes are the strategic things like, hey, we can get data to evaluate a market and a property from thousands of miles away. And then we can network with people that are very successful and they can teach us how to do it.
Yeah. Great point. To add to that, I think real estate private equity in general, especially for like how sponsors structure their deals and how they run their business, was very much a black box to even people who invested in real estate, like even people who took part in syndications. Like no one knew how to compare someone else's offerings, their fees, what they charge to other people, because the information was very tightly held. So I think we're also going to see sponsors like terms come closer together. Because there was outliers. There's some people with a 10% fee load and some people with 1.5%. And, you know, it's not a commodity, but to a certain extent, like pricing has to tighten. The spreads are really, really far apart among sponsors. I think the democratization of information is going to make that spread get real tight. So people are going to charge very similar fees and it'll turn into like the Vanguard structure. You know, like one fee charges almost the exact same thing to as another shop. So I think that's interesting too.
Yeah. It is. It's also interesting because I think from what we can tell, the active sponsors on Twitter are all pretty comparable. There's a spectrum, yeah, but it's pretty comparable. But we know some sponsors off Twitter that if they publicly shared their fee load, people would cry fraud, right? And some of these people are very well respected and they're getting a stable return for their clients, but some of the fee loads out there are crazy high.
Yeah. And they get away with that. You know, maybe some of them are providing a very differentiated product, but in most cases, they're probably not. The reason they get away with it is because their LPs in a lot of cases can't compare it to anything. Cause they're not like full-time LPs. But I think that will change to our point, like LPs will know more as time goes on.
Good. Next question. Number three, we got 10 of them. Number three, what are the key factors to consider when evaluating a potential commercial real estate investment? Let me rephrase the question some because that's a bland question.
Sure.
And go, hey, how did we initially evaluate deals and how has that evolved?
For storage in particular?
Yeah, sure.
I think everyone, when you first start out, and us included, are very like cap rate obsessed. Like, hey, this is trading at this cap rate and I don't like that cap rate or I do, right? And you try to oversimplify it. I think now, as we've grown, we value a couple of things more than when we first started. Potential future revenue. So future value is really important. How much value add is left in the deal? Another metric that I think is really important is price per square foot, particularly in a market that's not land constrained, right? If it's Manhattan and you can't build anymore, price per square foot, maybe not, shouldn't drive all your deals. But if you're investing in Oklahoma, it matters a lot, right? Because development risk is high. So price per square foot matters a lot, or more to us, I think, the more we've done this. And I mean, location. When you're a remote investor, you spend a lot of time looking at spreadsheets. When you don't operate in the state, you buy in. And more and more, I think we're becoming sensitive to traffic patterns. People have to drive past this location, and that's what makes the demand drivers in this area good. So the qualitative stuff, I think, matters more and more to us as time goes on.
I like it. I think agree with all that. I think the big way we've evolved is we've said we are willing to pay a higher price for a facility or a piece of real estate that is likely to have a better tailwind, right? Yeah. Where when you start out, it's really easy to be like, hey, investors, this place isn't charging enough. If we can just raise rates to market, it's going to be a good deal, right? And investors love that because it's really easy to understand. If you have to make a macroeconomic prediction and say, I think this area is going to appreciate faster than other areas, you are saying you have a little bit of a crystal ball. And it's a slightly more difficult pitch, right? But that's where we're going is we're saying, okay, I don't know what's going to be better between Tampa and Orlando. But I do know Tampa and Orlando are definitely going to see better appreciation than Lawton, Oklahoma. So I might not be able to quantify that perfectly, but how do we look at those differently and realize we can pay slightly more in a more competitive market?
For sure. And it's not like you're predicting the future. It's that you have a thesis and you're just looking for people that share that thesis. And I think
fair.
You know, that sounds really simple, but for some reason it doesn't to think like that, I think takes a little bit of time. I think there might be a little bit of insecurity when you first start out too. Like, I like this investment because there's this illusion of predictability, right? Because I can see, and some of it actually is real predictability. If your owner is down the street and they're charging 30% less that you're buying from, there's a pretty high confidence you can make more money than they're currently making, right? So because that's kind of like your security blanket when you first start out, it's probably appropriate that you look at deals that way. But then you're going to typically buy smaller deals if you're looking for massive, like 30 to 40% pricing arbitrage opportunities. Once in a while, they pop up on the big stuff, but not nearly as often. So that's the downside, right?
Yeah, I like it. All right, let's go. Number four, how do you approach risk management in your commercial real estate investments? So how do we think about risk?
I think risk is real, right? We personally guarantee debt. Some of our loans have balloon payments in 5 years, right? So anytime those two things are present, like, you have some risk. I think we generally want to have at least 200 bips spread between our yield on cost and our interest rate that we're going to pay, right? So that's one way. And I think deleveraging as debt service goes up and making sure you make debt service is the ultimate risk management practice in real estate. Like, to me, funding is the biggest part of this. Like, making sure your funding operation or how you fund your deals doesn't put you in a corner is the primary risk management practice we're actually in. Doing good deals is also a really, really big part of it. But I think funding's the thing I focus on the most in terms of making sure we're okay and strong.
For sure. I think we should say, though, that on a deal-to-deal basis, we refuse to underwrite lots of deals strictly based on the amount of risk, right? We always talk about Jackson, Mississippi. The numbers that we see deals in Jackson, Mississippi, that by the numbers, they look so amazing, yeah. Right? But Jackson, Mississippi, very low median income and population is getting smaller, right? So we're not going to buy in a location where the population is getting smaller. We're also not going to buy in super small town that is reliant on one big employer, right? So like, you have that stuff to make sure, like, hey, is it good real estate? Do we like it? Right. But then once it passed that test, then we go to that capital stack, like you're talking. And I like how you didn't just say loan to value. Like, that's what everyone talks about with risk is loan to value. But I think a much smarter way to look at it is your debt service coverage ratio, right? Like, a lot of times those are connected, right? But there's also deals where a 100% loan to value could be less risky than a 60% loan to value, depending on the cap rate and the debt service coverage ratio you look at, right? So,
yeah, I agree 100%. The last thing I think we try to do with risk management is we have done a good job of essentially having one extra staff member that can be like a utility player on our ops team. Like, we're a young company, we're small on a property management from a property management perspective, but we have like a little redundancy because we acknowledge, like, we don't want to stop collecting rent because someone quits or someone has an emergency or something, right? Like, so I think we're hedging our bet a little bit there too, which is good.
I like it. And then we talk about every deal. How do we make sure we don't lose money, right? Rule number one, don't lose money. Rule number two, make sure you don't forget rule number one, right? It's always at the foremost of our mind. All right, number five, can you share a story about a deal that was particularly challenging or rewarding? And what lessons did you learn from it?
You go first. I've gone first
a lot. Yeah, I think we bought two deals over the last 9 months or so. I don't have anything... I don't have a lot of bad stuff to say about those two deals. What I have is a lot of bad stuff to say about the other 40 deals we looked at that didn't end up happening, right? As acquisitions guy, that's where I'm spending my time. So what is challenging and rewarding? What's challenging is getting deals to pencil. And then, you know, let's say someone wants $4 million for a deal. You look at the debt you can get and what it's performing at and what you think the future potential is. And you're like, hey, I can't pay over $3 million for this, right? And the price is $4 million. So that's super challenging. I think the rewarding aspect is we've had a couple instances where we had to get creative, where we had to take a deal down all cash to get it done. And we did. We had another deal where we went seller financing. And then during due diligence period, things got a little dicey. So we had to adjust those seller financing terms, right? The ability, like some of that is really rewarding, right? Where you're like, this isn't financial engineering, but it's taking a complex problem and being like, okay, there's like a psychology to this. There's a financial aspect to this. How can you make sure buyer, seller, brokers all stay on the same page, but you get it done?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that is, I think the most rewarding part of doing what we're doing is like obviously locking up a deal is probably the biggest high you get. It's not even the closing. It's like getting it under contract is a great feeling. But rewarding work is like getting that deal and when it slides off the tracks, like getting it back on track. Like there's a lot of problem solving in our business that is rewarding. Like, hey, this popped up. And a lot of times for a company our size, like the owner has to step in and guide parties to the right spot. And that is rewarding, right? To kind of like be the shepherd. A current challenge, this isn't deal specific, but I think it's relevant now that I have. And I think you might have it too. We're like 2 years into our transition into commercial real estate. I think it was May, like 2021, when we were like, hey, like, let's start looking at self-storage or mobile home parks when we made our decision. And we've been doing this 2 years, and I feel like the kind of like the lightness and like grace you give yourself as a beginner is like gone. Like, I don't think we, like at some point over the last 6 months, our frame of mind was like, no, we're not beginners anymore. Like, I think we know what we're doing. So we're trying to act like more professional, but what does that also mean? Our expectations are probably a lot higher for ourselves when this is happening at the same time that deal flow is jamming up across the whole ecosystem. So you have like the pressure of being a high performer and like no one looking at you like a little kid anymore, coupled with the fact that you can't get deals locked up, right? So like, it's just like there's pressure in the business, and that is a challenge. And I think there's probably a ton of people that are experiencing that. So it's hard to put into words, but I think that is a current challenge for people, I think, right now.
Yeah, I will definitely agree with that. I think the way I would internalize that or kind of share it is just we see people doing big deals. And there was a point where we were like, hey, this person is more experienced. They're smarter. They're better connected. That's why they're doing bigger deals. Well, we're to the point where we're like, those might not be true. So we know we have the ability to build a super strong portfolio, right? And I think we're on track to do that, but the acquisition machine deal flow gets a vote, right? So it's difficult to be patient. It's also difficult to give yourself a pat on the back because we're doing all the right things. The deals just aren't coming, right? Luckily, we're in a financial position where we're still able to focus on our business, you know, 40 hours a week or whatever and keep things going. But there is some tension there, right? Not between us, just tension with like, hey, we know this is going to work. We know 2 years from now, we're going to have a great portfolio. Getting those deals is a grind though.
Yeah, for sure. And then, you know, when you do that for months on end and you do it every day, it's natural to have thoughts like, hey, I think I know what I'm doing, but am I the idiot for not buying this? Like, is this fund that I keep seeing close all these deals I offer on, are they smarter than I am? I don't think they are, right? But I'm just saying, like, it's very easy to go down that path when things are slow. So that is a challenge.
Sure. Question number six, how have your backgrounds as West Point graduates and Army football team captains influenced your approach to commercial real estate investing? I promise this wasn't a plug. ChatGPT came up with this.
Yeah, that's so amazing. I feel cool that ChatGPT knew this.
Yeah, right?
that's cool. I don't know. I think there's a high accountability in our company. I think we
we generally hold everybody and ourselves to a high standard. I think that that largely stems from our West Point background. I think we're pretty comfortable being like, hey, we're operating here, but the bar needs to be up here. And I think, you know, a little Spartan-esque attitude, I think, is mixed in with that. But I think we're doing a good job of handling it, although sometimes there's tension because of that. So I think that's one. I'm struggling to come up with number two, though. So I'm gonna pass it to you because I can't think of anything else.
I think the biggest thing from like the West Point and football experience is just like figure it the fuck out, right? Like, yeah, you know, Army leadership. At West Point, they don't teach us like, you know, be a great leader, you know, unless you have soldiers that don't want to listen to you, then don't be a great leader, right? They're like, no, be a great leader, figure it out, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what if I don't know the answer? It doesn't matter, figure it out, right? So I think part of that is ingrained into us. The other thing I would say is in the circles that we network in, there's very few West Point graduates, Army football players, whatever, right? So just like that storyline, when everyone introduces themselves and they're like, this is what I did, right? Like, you know, I think partly we're like, man, it would be cool if we had, you know, went to Wharton and got an MBA from Wharton and majored in finance and all this stuff. But the bottom line is when we're sitting in circles with people like that and they're like, oh, you went to West Point? Oh, you played Army football? That's interesting to a lot of people, right? So I think that helps us as well. We always say we win in person, right? So if we can get meetings and people can kind of hear our story, I think it's interesting to most people and we can pass that like initial vibe check of being fun guys to be around.
I agree. I agree with that. I think that does help sometimes with the capital raising, but if you actually take a big step back and like, how does it affect our business? It makes being a sponsor in your 30s really hard, because if you're in the Army for 5 to 10 years, which we both were, it pretty much guarantees by the time you're 30, you're not rich already. Like, not complaining about the Army's pay. You lived in a nice townhome. You did the same. You had a house. Life is good, right? You bought a house. It's a good life, but you're not going to make $1 million. It's just not going to happen. So it does discourage people from going out and being sponsors, because the road to be able to start this type of business in your early 30s, it's really hard unless you already have money. So there's not going to be a lot of us. And that's just the way it is.
And then I think to double down on that, the networking piece, right? Like in the Army, you're not networking with brokers or lenders or bankers or family offices, right? So there's a certain point over the last 2 years where we were like, hey, we need to improve our network in these areas. And we've had to work our ass off to get there, as opposed to if we went to, you know, some of these schools and majored in finance, there'd be a bunch of people in our classes that we could reach out to, right? Like, we know people in commercial real estate, but the West Point community in commercial real estate is really small.
The people in it are good, but it's small. That's how I would put it. There's great people there, but there's only a handful of them. Yep.
Sure. Number eight. Number seven. Sorry. What advice do you have for new investors looking to break into the commercial real estate market?
I think now more than ever, unless you're really well capitalized and can afford a loss or two, or to take a hit, like maybe lose pursuit costs or something, like you can lose 50 grand and not crush you. If you're not in that boat, I think partnering up is really important right now, just because of how low volume deals are commercial real estate. So like living off acquisition fees, if you're able to find people that are okay with you not putting in your own funds, is going to be really tough. So I think going in, working for another sponsor, kind of like Moses Kagan's Redeem program, I think that's like the absolute perfect example of like working under someone else's tutelage or guidance. Or, you know, about, I think a year from now, it might be a great opportunity to start being a broker in commercial real estate. I think it's crowded now, but it's starting to thin out a little bit. And I think someone, if they can stomach a year or two of not making a lot of money, can start building those relationships with the new class of buyers that are going to become really wealthy during the next cycle. I think that's a great opportunity. And I think being a broker is an amazing job. So those are two things that I would pursue.
Yeah, I like that. I think my default answer is like, don't do it, right? I think it's tough.
Yeah.
Right. Like, there's a lot of people in the military that flipped a couple houses and they're like, I want to go buy apartment complexes. Like, good luck, man. Like, it's a big jump, right? So my first advice for people that feel this entrepreneurial spirit is to go check out small, medium-sized businesses. Go to Sam Rosati's Pursuing Capital bootcamp. Go check those things out, right? Some people are like, hey, no, I want to get in real estate. Okay, I agree with the broker route. I think that's, if you want to do what we're doing, I think the broker route is the best way to go for it. I wouldn't look for a big shop though. Like, let's say you wanted to get into industrial, I would go to where you want to live or where you think there's plenty of industrial buildings. And I would go try to find kind of like a boutique industrial brokerage. And I'd go work for those people. I would also make sure that I had enough cash in the bank to live for at least 12 months because it's probably going to be 6 to 12 months before you get your first commission check. But you're going to know 30, 60 days in if you can cut it and if it's for you. And if you can't, and you have some type of finance background, I think you can look to commercial lending. You can look to, you know, go into property management. There's different places you can go from that. But if you're looking to be a GP, starting from Jump Street, I think is really tough. I would look to brokerage route.
It's interesting. You said like, don't go to like CBRE or M&M, Marcus & Millichap. Why? What's wrong with starting out in those shops?
Well, I think most of the time they're going to have you start as an analyst, right? And you're going to have to put your time in. I think those jobs are mostly for kids just coming out of college. So if you are just coming out of college and you want to go grind for 2 years, I think that's good. But you're going to have to grind for a couple years before they let you actually go work on deals, right? And interface with buyers and sellers, right? And if your goal is to go be a GP as fast as possible, you're not going to get that experience. Where if you go to a boutique shop, you're going to be able to see the whole deal process in a shorter time frame.
Yeah. Thinner pipeline maybe, right? But yeah, I gotcha.
You're going to be able to own deals from day one in a boutique shop, right? Even if it's just leasing stuff, like you're going to be able to work with buyers and sellers from day one at a boutique shop. Where if you go to Marcus & Millichap, number one, it's hard to get jobs there, right? But even if you do get jobs, from what I've heard, I've never worked it, but you're going to be an analyst for a period of time. And like that's good stuff to know, but it's definitely, they're going to make you pay your dues.
Yeah. Yeah, I gotcha. Okay.
All right. Question number 8, how do you build and maintain relationships with key partners and stakeholders in the commercial real estate industry?
I mean, I feel like we're communicating outwards all the time. Every single day, you and I, you or I or both, are communicating with an existing investor, a broker, or a new investor. I'd say almost every single day, Monday through Friday. I think we're pretty good on the weekends of turning it off, but I think we do it a lot. And I think like, how do we do it? We each have a CRM. You have a broker CRM essentially, and an investor one bucket. I have an investor bucket. And then we have all of our investor communications that go out every single month for every single property. And that's the minimum. There's other stuff that goes on too. I actually track now our like top like 10 to 15 investors, and I track like how often I contact them. So it's gotten to the point now where we have to organize it because it's gotten kind of like a big effort at this point. So we're trying to stay organized and just like keep striking all the time is my answer.
Yeah. I think How to Win Friends and Influence People is such an amazing book. And then I think coupled with kind of Never Eat Alone and then Nick Gray's new book, the 2-hour cocktail party, but put all that together, it's like, be interested in people, right? Like, let's say you meet two brokers. One broker is around your age, around your stage of life, likes to golf, and also, you know, likes good food. The other broker is 60 years old, talks about deals that he did in the 80s, and, you know, likes going to the opera. It's going to be really different experiences networking with both those people. The person that's more similar to me, like there's a good chance after two lunches, like we're BFFs, right? Like genuinely, even if we don't do deals, it's just going to be easy to connect with that person. And then the person that I'm not going to connect with as well, like I kind of, it's not like I give up on that, but I chalk it up to what it is. Like I'm going to have to put in 10 times as much effort to maintain that relationship is this other relationship. So I look at the networking piece as like, I try to find lenders and brokers and investors and mentors that I like spending time with to begin with. So then when I reach out to them, it can be, hey, do you want to go to a Lightning game? Do you want to go out to lunch? Do you want to genuinely talk about life? And hey, if business comes up, that's all great. And I think as you play the long game, that's the only way to do it.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. How often do you find, do those relationships where the people take more work, do you like, when do you tap out? How do you know?
I don't know if it's tapping out as much as it's not tapping in, right? I think like, I'm not so eager for relationships that, I'm being, I don't have to be that proactive to maintain a bunch of relationships, right? Like my schedule is full based on maintaining relationships and creating a couple new ones here and there, right? So it's not like I tap out, but if someone's going to be difficult, like I just don't spend any time from start to finish, right? Unless it's like, you know, hey, there's these underlying values that I think, you know, in the long term, we're going to be able to work through all that. But there's so many awesome people that are similar to us that I just don't spend time there.
Yeah. I think another thing is that we've learned is when you don't jive with someone, and sometimes it's like, I don't have a good feeling about this guy or gal. But maybe there's like some business opportunity that will follow along in that relationship or you think it's there. If when you have that feeling at the beginning, 90% of the time, they never become an actual counterparty to your business. Like that if you looked at all the times we had an instinct, like, I don't know about this person, the time spent with them, it almost always comes back to like, yeah, they were who we thought. You know what I mean? So when you have a red flag on somebody, it's probably better to just move on right away. You know, like that's just the way it is.
For sure. I think two different people I golf with recently. One, I spent 4 hours in their cart. And from like the second hole, I was like, this guy, he has like no ambition at all. Right. So like, even though his, you know, he had an amazing job. I was really excited to connect with him. I was like, his ambition is so low. Like we're not going to jive on that connection. Then a different guy I was really excited to meet, and play golf with him. Right after I met him, I was like, this guy's a dick. Like, not like, hey, he knows what he wants and he tells you what he wants, but he's just rude. I'm like, life's too short to spend time like hanging around people like that. Right. So
yeah,
sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, for sure. Better off being decisive. For sure. Go ahead.
All right. In light of current economic climate, how do you think investors should adapt their strategies to ensure success in commercial real estate?
I think it depends, how much money you have. Like for us, I think the right play is like, continue to be selective, focus on the unlevered yield on cost. So you have some guiding light as rates move a lot. Unlevered yield on cost is, hey, the unlevered yield or return on the asset. So imagine no debt, over the total cost of the project. So purchase price typically plus rehab or improvement costs, right? That number, if you feel good about it, like you can hold that property probably forever, right? So it's a good fundamental to pay attention to. But you know, controversial thought, if you gave me a couple $1 billion, I would probably, nothing could sink me, right? Like I was just really strong, huge cash position. I would probably start placing a lot of bets on variable rate debt, or adjustable rate debt, because like history has shown, you know, when prices come off their highs and rates, you're in a higher rate environment, like that actually, if you can hold long term, like that has the best returns. Like that aggressive play makes a lot of sense. But I think we're small to the point where we could risk the house, or our investor's house by placing that type of bet. But I think actually people who are aggressive right now, like part of me is like, yeah, good for you, man. Like good for you. But we have to be more cautious and careful. What do you think?
Interesting. My thought is just, I believe in dollar cost averaging. You're not going to time the market, right? So I think my overarching thought is like, stick to fundamentals, buy good deals, but don't go pencil down. Don't stop buying deals. Like if you put in debt into the equation right now, you can see like deals are super, super thin, right? But if you go price per square foot right now, and that's all you looked at, deals are cheaper. There's some deals cheaper now than they've been at any point in the last at least 2 years, you know? Yeah. So by that metric, like it's a great time to buy, right? So I think it's confusing. I don't have a perfect answer, but I definitely think if I'm an investor, I'm trying to get into deals, even if they're a little tighter right now, even if that IRR doesn't look quite as sexy, because I'm trying to dollar cost average. And I actually think, depending on how you look at it, things are on sale right now.
Yeah, I think multifamily in a lot of places actually is on sale. It definitely relative to 2022 and late 21. I agree. I think that's timeless advice, what you just said, for sure.
Well, I think even storage is on sale. We're looking at some storage deals where the price per square foot is cheaper than it would be over the last 24 months. The interesting thing is rental rates are down, right? Mm-hmm. So if you believe rental rates are going to recover and continue to grow, it is in fact on sale, right? The price per square foot is on sale. But if you look at a cap rate on current, right, it looks overpriced, right? So, you know, it all depends what you think is going to happen in the future. It could be overpriced right now, or it could be a steal.
Yeah, that is the biggest, that is honestly an underrated issue for deal flow right now, is customer demand and storage. The interest rates are, we're already going to jam up deal flow, but brokers saying there's 15% revenue growth and pitching that in the OMs with operators that are like, hey man, rates are down from April of 2022. Like those two things don't mix. So like that is also crushing deal flow too. Great point.
Okay. Final question. Looking ahead, what are your goals for Great Line Investments? How do you plan to continue growing the company?
You go.
Okay. I think the plan is we're both very ambitious guys. So we're going to continue to grow a large real estate portfolio. Are we going to syndicate deals or create a fund? We're on a path right now to create a fund looking at industrial. We're going to keep looking at storage. We got some exciting storage deals coming down the pike. And you know, what is our 5-year, 10-year, 30-year? Like those are difficult questions to answer. I think what we want to do is keep growing competence and ambition. And ideally, like we bought $17 million of storage last year. Like it'd be nice to do $25 million this year and then 35, 40 million, right? And like have kind of a linear growth like that. Tricky thing is like the market gets a vote, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think our competency is growing significantly, our connections, our ability to find deals, fund deals, and finish deals, all that stuff's growing, but the market gets a vote. So, you know, in reality, how are we going to continue to grow? We're going to, you know, make sure that we place, you know, strong bets on deals that we really believe in.
Yeah, I agree. There's no like retirement number that I'm interested in. And even at this point, like the 10-year AUM number, like how many, what's the number of the dollar value of the assets under our management? I think it's kind of a weird time to like throw numbers like that out with the unpredictability. So I think for us, it's like, hey, keep working at this. We know we can get to a scale within our company where if we have industrial in the portfolio and storage, maybe we have two verticals right in the company that can operate somewhat autonomously without our intervention, like having a scaled real estate private equity company that does really good deals and consistently hits targets. Like that is a great company, you know, that the fees can support itself, which we're working on. I don't know the number of total assets. I don't know the number. Maybe it's $1 billion. Who knows?
Yeah, I think it'll keep growing. It'll be fun. I think, you know, if we go out far enough too, I think we'll eventually start doing development deals. I think we'll eventually be a holding company that has some ancillary services or SMB lines underneath us. That being said, like we got a rock and storage business with an awesome general manager in Adam that rocks that business. We're standing up an industrial business. So I think our pacing is really important, but we feel good about our pacing at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. Good word. I agree.
Cool. All right, man. Fun episode. Like I said, we had to do a last minute change because schedule adjusted. Hopefully this is decent content. We appreciate you listening though. Our, audience numbers have been skyrocketing over the last, you know, 3 or 4 months. So we really appreciate you listening. Continue to send Frank and I emails if you've got input, frank@greylineinvestments.com, john@greylineinvestments.com. Hit us up on Twitter and make sure you get on our email list. We got some exciting things coming out. Frank, take us away, man.
Yeah. Reminder, join the email list, do it. And for those of you that reached out to us, gave us some encouragement after we had some really great guests and good episodes recently, thank you all. See you next week. Peace.